This is Deanna Spingola. It is Thursday, June 28th, 2012, and this is one of my special interviews. We have no commercials, no censorship, no calls, and no music. It is just education and information. It is bare bones broadcasting. My guest today is Carl Radl, R-A-D-L. He is the author of Communism and the Jews, a source reader. His website is SemiticController.blogspot.com. Welcome to the program, Carl.
Thank you, Deanna.
Okay, so you've got a good story to tell about Damascus and what happened there in 1840. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Well, to anyone who has studied Jews or Jewish history, Damascus 1840 is a watershed moment. It is the first time in modern history that we have a defined case of organized Jewish power being used and being openly acknowledged as such by both anti-Jewish and pro-Jewish historians. The case of 1840 also includes several key historical events in the history of Jewry as we understand it. It was the birth of the Alliance Universale Israelite, so Adolf Kremer's organization. It involved one of the largest power sort of mobilizations of Jewish power in Europe, especially elite Jewish power, that had occurred up to that time, notably with the Rothschilds. And it also gives us some evidence of the fact that the Rothschilds were manipulating political and world opinion to their advantage. The actual affair is a ritual murder trial, and it is one of the best evidence that we have. There are many ritual murder trials in history. They stretched from the from the 4th century BC right down to the present day, when you've had several accusations in recent years in Saudi Arabia. You've had them in Iran. You've had them in North Africa. However, historically, they have been a primarily European phenomena, although there is an increasing literature on the subject of the Islamic ritual murder phenomenon. So Jewish ritual murder in Islamic lands, which has largely been a forgotten sub-issue within the study. What is ritual murder? Well, ritual murder is very simply, it is an event where Jews are accused, rightly or not, though both cases do exist, almost certainly, of ritually killing non-Jews for ritual purposes. So they're doing it because they believe that it has some significance in Judaism. Recent theories of it suggest either that it was a fraud conducted by Christians, which I don't believe, given its how wide the spread of ritual murder accusations are, and also how tightly they cluster in historically. They are very tightly clustered historically, and they also have various factors in common, and they also follow directly the pattern of Jewish emigration across Europe. So they start off in England, and then they go from England through France, through Germany, down to Italy, down to Spain, and then across into Eastern Europe, and then again we see them go into Islamic lands once Europeans go there, and Jews again occur, are there in large numbers and have power. Now, to understand what happened at Damascus, we need to understand the geopolitical events that led up to the affair. The first thing is that the Ottoman Empire had ruled Syria, which is the capital, whose capital is Damascus, for a couple of centuries. However, at this time, they had appointed a governor of Egypt called Ali Muhammad. And Ali Muhammad was, up till the Greek Revolt in the late 1830s, a loyal subject of the Sultan. However, during the Greek Revolt, Ali Muhammad and his son were very important in putting down a revolt, but they didn't feel they got the credit they deserved from the Sultan. The Sultan largely ignored the key role that they played in it, and instead he supported his favourites at court. So Ali Muhammad came up with basically revolted against the Sultan. He did something that no one expected. He acquired all the Ottoman Empire apart from Turkey, the Anatolian area and Constantinople, plus the Balkans and Greece, which these were the places. So every other possession the Ottomans had, he owned. He had Rhodes, he had Cyprus, so forth. What happened is that he managed to defeat the Ottoman Empire, armies in battle, in a view that would take a revolution that undermined European interests, general European interests in the Ottoman Empire, because all of a sudden you had a new power being born out of this older empire. And because he defeated all the Ottoman Empire's armies in battle, and the Ottoman fleet had defected to him, immediately he began to look for accreditation and sort of recognition among the European states. This is, however, not forthcoming, because, after all, Ali Muhammad was revolting against his sovereign lord, according to European theory, and also they were very keen to keep the Ottoman Empire very, very powerful in order to counterbalance Russia. This was particularly true of the British, who were deeply worried about growing Russian power in Asia and the threat that potentially exposed them to in India, and the fact that the Russians were looking towards Afghanistan, and the British had invaded Afghanistan and were deep in Afghanistan at about the time of the Manassas affair. In addition to this, they had Austrian support with Prince Metternich, very famous if you've read any history of the Rothschilds, in that he was a key figure in supporting and getting the Rothschilds into the position that they are, that they then occupied in Austria. And also, he consulted the Rothschild before he made an awful lot of political moves. That's not to say he was a tool of the Rothschilds, because he often disagreed with them, but at the same time, he had a strong relationship with them, and if they asked him to do something, he tended to do it, precisely because they were his bankers. They bankrolled a lot of his political schemes. Now, what actually happened in Damascus? Well, it was ruled by Sherif Pasha, who was Ali Muhammad's adopted son. Notes just went sideways. There's a tense religious atmosphere as the Christian and Jewish quarters, were mini fortresses. You had a home in Damascus was literally a castle. You would have a small inconspicuous entrance off a side street. You wouldn't have any big windows near the ground floor where people could attack you, throw burning embers in, that kind of thing. It also had a very high crime rate, evidence this tension by the fact that 20 years later, after the affair in 1860, there were anti-Christian riots in Damascus which killed 10 Catholic monks, as well as later you have additional anti-Jewish riots, other anti-Christian riots, and various attacks on each other by the Christians on the Muslims and the Jews on the Muslims and so forth. The local political situation had recently shifted quite substantially, because under the Ottoman Empire, the government of Damascus was effectively Jewish. The Salaf, the chief accountant or the chief financier of the Ottoman administration of Damascus, was Rafael Fahi, who was the richest Jew in Damascus. He owned a house that was allegedly worth approximately $72,000, and that would be approximate to about to a couple of tens of million dollars today in terms of actual buying power. The Jews of Damascus had been the tax collectors. They had been aides and the bankers to the governors of Syria. And this is particularly true of two families, the Farhis and the Harahis, both of whom were massively wealthy in Damascus. To give you some idea of the wealth that we are talking about here, a pro-Jewish statistician, John Bowring, worked out that several prominent out of several prominent Jews of Damascus, most notably the Farhis and Halahi families that we discussed, their combined wealth amounted to a whopping $800,000 USD. And that's several billion by today's standards in terms of buying power. And this was presented, as I said, in a second public meeting led by the elite of British Jewry, the Goldschmidts, the Rothschilds, the Montefiores. And to give some idea of the scale of just how much money this was, a gentleman of leisure in Europe, a man who didn't have to work his life, had many servants and could basically do what he wanted all day long, was a man who had an income of $5,000 to $7,500 a year. That is many, many times over the wealth of what these Jews had. And also, these Jews had quite a lot of contacts in Europe. They, particularly in Italy, they had a lot of mercantile contacts. They were key figures in the old trade routes that have been set up. We can sort of evidence the power of these bankers by citing the instance of the famed explorer, linguist, and scholar Sir Richard Francis Burton, who, during his tenure as British Vice Consul in Damascus in the 1860s and 1870s, discovered that the Jews were incredibly powerful in Damascus, and this is after, of course, the affair. There's a situation where some Greek Christians owed some Jews some money. The Jews immediately demanded that Burton get British foreign policy behind their recovery of their debts. So Burton said, "Well, no, go away, because that is not my role as British Vice Consul." Burton, being an experienced Vice Consul, plus a noted linguist, as I've said, who spoke Hebrew, Arabic, Yiddish, etc. And these Jews then wrote to their friends in London. They then got Burton recalled. And the consul from Alexandria came up and basically did exactly what the Jews wanted him to do, and he was given Burton's appointment in addition to that, plus the salary that entailed. Burton's story on this is supported by his friend, and fellow Arabist, plus a fully paid-up member of the English aristocracy, Lady Jane Digby, who was also resident in Damascus at the time. She basically said, yes, Burton was got rid of by the Jews, and that the Jews in Damascus were horrendously powerful. The actual events of 1840, after we consider this, context, is that it surrounds the disappearance of a Sardinian Capuchin monk and his servant. The monk's name was Father Thomas, he was known as the Capuchin or Padre Tommaso on the streets of Damascus. And his servant, who was Ibrahim Amala, who'd been his servant for 32 years, Father Thomas had lived in Damascus for 32 years. He was well known as a figure. He spoke fluent Arabic. He knew the locals, etc. And he was protected by the French, because the French had a treaty that went with the Ottoman Empire that went back to the Crusader era, whereby the French were any Catholic monk or churchman in Damascus or in the Ottoman Empire was under the protection of the French Empire, and the French Empire would step in if anything happened to them, and there would be repercussions for the Ottoman citizens in French lands. So, in effect, he was under French protection. This wasn't uncommon, as you had other merchants there who were under Austrian protection and others who were under British protection. So this kind of arrangement was not uncommon, particularly among the Jews. Well, first of all, Father Thomas was very well known in Damascus. He gave free medical care and particularly vaccinations to the poor, but he possibly seems to have charged the wealthy if they wanted his medical services. This is particularly important because Damascus at the time was a place of there's an awful lot of disease there. There's a lot of measles, malaria, and so forth that was plaguing citizens. And Father Thomas, as being one of the few European physicians in the city, was one of the best placed to actually give them the medical care that they needed. The fact he'd survived 32 years in such a volatile city speaks for his streetwise nature and the fact that he knew what to do and how to handle himself, and that it is not likely, as some Jewish and pro-Jewish historians have claimed, that he was killed by Muslims who got angry with him, effectively, is their claim.
Sure. Well, don't they always blame someone else?
Yes, they do. We all know that. They always blame someone else. It's never their fault. It's always someone else or an anti-Semitic conspiracy of some description.
Sure.
Okay, the actual, what led up, what the events of that affair are as follows. At midday on February the 6th, 1840, Father Thomas had been expected for dinner with Dr. Massari, the Sheriff Pasha's personal physician. But in spite of normally being a very prompt man, neither Thomas or Amara turned up or sent word that they were going to be late or couldn't make it. This caused enough alarm from Dr. Massari and his guests for them to set out on a hasty search party to find Father Thomas and his servant. And this was unsuccessful. And they promptly reported him missing to the French consulate, which was headed by the recently arrived Vice Consul Benoît Laurent François de Paul-Ulissy, otherwise known as the Comte Ratimental, who was assisted by the long-term French resident of Damascus, Jean-Baptiste Baudin. Baudin, who was fluent in English, German, French, Greek, Arabic, and Hebrew, served as Ratimental's interpreter and official agent, especially in dealing with the Ottoman court, so he was an expert in procedure, knowing what to say, when to say it at the Ottoman court, which was all important if you're going to get on in the diplomatic intrigues that were going on between the British, the Austrians, the Prussians, and the French. It was quickly established by Baudin that Father Thomas had been missing since the night before, Wednesday the 5th of February, when a French pharmacist, Monsieur Santi, had dropped by the Capuchin monastery to return a book he had borrowed from Father Thomas, only to discover the father and his servant not in, which, as Michel Santi said, was very unusual, because usually they were promptly back every night. In addition, on the morning of Thursday, the 6th of February, on the Wednesday, the local Catholics, as in the Arab Catholics of the population, had turned up at the monastery, the Capuchin monastery, for matins, i.e. morning mass, as normal, but couldn't raise anyone in the monastery. We should bear in mind that Father Thomas was alone in the monastery, and he was in the Capuchin there, and it was him and his servant alone. Those who turned up early charitably chalked it up to the fact that the father's non-appearance was perhaps he'd overslept. Those who turned up late just assumed they'd missed mass. We need to remember that precise time was not something in use in Damascus at this time, and time was tended to be expressed in terms of its relation to the Islamic muezzin, i.e. calls to prayer that occurred throughout the day. So, like in Christian Europe, you would refer to just before the matins bell, or just after the matins bell, that kind of thing. So we don't find precise times in the testimonies or the court protocols, but we tend to find, but rather between such and such a muezzin, okay? Mm-hmm. What was also established by Baudin was that Father Thomas had been in the Jewish quarter during Wednesday to vaccinate a Jewish child against smallpox and or to place a notice on the door of a synagogue about a charity auction to help Dr. Telenova, a physician working for the Egyptian military who had fallen on hard times. Neither practice was uncommon for Father Thomas, who regularly offered medical care to the Jews and posted notices on charitable events on the door of synagogue. Based on these alarming reports concerning the disappearance of Father Thomas and Baudin's investigation, Ratimental and Baudin, on the evening of Thursday, the 6th of February, went with the aid of some local Christians, broke down the door of the monastery, only to find that everything was as it should be in a monastery, other than there being no evidence of Father Thomas and Ibrahim Armada. Dishes of food were laid out ready for preparation. Dishes were out ready to be used in serving the meal. This, as Ratimental concluded, suggested that Father Thomas and Armada had been planning to return on the Wednesday evening, but for some reason had not done so. Surprisingly, Raffi Menton and Bardin also discovered that Father Thomas was a rich man, as he had some $5,500 to $6,000 in silver in a locked chest in his room. But the house showed no signs of disturbance, and nothing was missing. So the silver was there, so we can rule out any kind of theft, and we can also rule out the involvement of Amala, as why would he not take the silver so he could run away? Raffi Menton and Baudin were then met with a Christian crowd who had heard of some leaked details of the case, but most particularly that Father Thomas and Amala had been last seen in the Jewish quarter. There were shouts that the Jews had killed the Capuchin and his servant, and some began to speculate that there was a ritual murder case, although this was ignored by the French consul and his staff, most importantly at this time. The Jews begin to be suspected once we start dealing the next day. On the Friday, the 7th of February, Sherif Pasha, having heard of the disappearance of Father Thomas and Amala, again, he had many spies throughout the city, so he would have easily found out about this, formally offered to help the French in their investigation, which Raffi Menton accepted, and sent an official into the Jewish quarter to question the Jews about what they had seen when they'd last seen Father Thomas and Amala, even though it was the Islamic day of rest. Basically, it was their equivalent of a Sunday. Of course, this was not particularly stringently observed because of the fact that the questioning wasn't particularly stringent because the official was trying to get back for the fact that this was his day of rest. He didn't really want to be there.
Mm-hmm.
The day after, which is Saturday the 8th of February, which was the Jewish Sabbath, having not turned up any evidence of Father Thomas, a more thorough search was organised of the Jewish quarter, and Father Thomas and his servant where they would have been, in addition to the Jewish quarter as well. The focus of the search, as I said, was the Jewish quarter, where it was led by the Pasha's chief of police, Ali Aga, and accompanied by the physician, Dr. Francis Salina. We have various horror stories from the Jews about this search. These date from the time that the European Jews got involved in the case, with the Jews of Damascus claiming that the soldiers just barged in, sat around smoking, ate their food, destroyed their belongings, dug up the fresh graves in the Jewish community, fondled and made lewd remarks about Jewish women, and so forth. This is usually used to try and demonstrate the bad faith and victimisation of the Jewish community at an early stage in the investigation. But as we'll see, scare stories were quickly being manufactured by the Jewish community. And at the late stage, when these claims surface, being sourced as they are from uncorroborated Jewish testimony to the mission of Montefiore Clemieux in July and August of 1840, i.e. months after the supposed events. In addition, we know of numerous and largely uncontested, even by the pro-Jewish side of the debate, cases throughout the investigation where the Jews writ large, as well as several individual members of it on their own initiative, tried to bribe the authorities and witnesses to make the investigation go away, which necessarily throws doubt into doubt any testimony offered by the Jews, notwithstanding the fact that we also, as we shall later cover, have known instances of Jews lying about Raffi Menton and Baudin, in particular to try and remove them from the investigation. We can also see the truthfulness in the assertion of Jewish victimization. We can also see the lack of truthfulness in the assertion of Jewish victimization, insofar as the investigation of this day turned up two witnesses, both of whom were not Jewish. They're both Christians called Mikhail Keslab and Nama Kalam, who stated that they had seen and had been in the Jewish quarter shortly before sunset on Wednesday, the 5th of February. They had seen seven or eight men with their faces covered, walking quickly down the main street. They independently stated they had overheard these men ask Amala, as they were only a few steps away, where he was going, and that Amala had answered that he was going to find his master and bring him home. This gave some idea that whoever had abducted Father Thomas was in the Jewish quarter at the time. Whether or not they were Jews, no one was quite sure yet. The Pasha had become suspicious that there was some kind of criminal gang operating in the Jewish quarter by this point. So Sherif Pasha decided to release a serial debtor and a former tax collector under the Ottoman regime, who had actually served under Rafi al-Farhi, Saeed Mohammed Al-Tali from prison, writing mental and graciously agreed to pay his small outstanding debt, incidentally. On the understanding that he was to use his known contacts among the Jewish community to ferret out the truth of what had happened. It's important to note that at this point in time, nobody in official circles was even thinking in terms of Jewish ritual murder, but rather that the evidence pointed to Jews being potentially involved, but not certainly so. In addition to all the foregoing points, the chief of police and Selena had discovered the charity auction notice for Dr. Telenova that Father Thomas had been putting up was not on the door of the synagogue as normal, but rather had been moved nearby outside the shop of a newly married and rather poor Jewish barber named Solomon Al-Halak. Later that day, at the suggestion of Al-Tali, the Pasha's soldiers arrested Al-Halak and took him to the French consulate for questioning. Of course, as his shop was next to it. It's quite a reasonable thing to do.
Sure.
The testimony of witnesses and evidence of the charity auction, caused Sheikh Pasha to require the chief rabbi, basically he was the official representative of the Jewish community, not a chief rabbi as we would understand him, Jacob Antabi, to produce Father Thomas and Amala as soon as possible. This is usually pictured as in sinister terms, but it is not. It's not so, because it's actually a fairly normal Islamic practicing Islamic jurisprudence at the time. It worked quite logically on the assumption that if a community or specific group within society were directly implicated in a crime, then the best way to ferret out the culprit or those who were potentially abducted by them was to order and thus motivate the group themselves to find them, as they would best know where all the hiding spots and their own criminals were. However, the system does not work if those implicated are the elite of the community who are supposed to be doing the ferreting out. At this point, we should note that Shalif Pasha had no reason to suspect Antabi's own involvement in the disappearance of Thomas and Amala. Antabi's response to this was rather formal, perhaps overly so, in that he did only what was expected of him, but also did something quite strange. As he called a meeting of the Jews who attended his synagogue, and bear in mind, this is not all the Jews of Damascus, and the elite of the community, where he stated that rumours and terrible accusations had been directed towards the Jews. Note the fact that Antabi is anticipating the course of the investigation here, and that anyone who had knowledge of the disappearance of Thomas or Amala should come forward at once on pain of excommunication. Now, to bear in mind, the excommunication was not the grand punishment that we or an Islamic person would see it as. Rather, it is simply Antabi saying, you cannot come in my synagogue again. It doesn't mean that the Jew cannot go to another synagogue, it just means you can't come in my synagogue again, and you can't worship at that particular one. That kind of throws to the wind an awful lot of the attempts to argue that Antabi was being particularly helpful, because this was a punishment that really had no weight whatsoever. He also drew back the curtain during the service, covering the Torah scrolls, and someone, no one seems to know who, blew the shofar, i.e. the ram's horn that was blown on Yom Kippur, both of which are only done on celebration days or festivals, and they're both common again to Yom Kippur, which is many months distant. But they're kind of unusual unless one considers that Antabi was addressing a crowd containing those not accused and those later accused of the crime. This tends to be considered to be one of the basis of Antabi's honesty, because he did this and it was supposed to show that he was trying his best to do what he was trying to find Father Thomas to prevent what then happened. The formal speech and the slight theatrics may have been designed to have a double meaning, precisely because of the Torah and Shofar symbology of the destruction of the enemies of the Jews, in addition to being symbols of their faith. In essence, you could say that while it was a good outward show, it was also the potential double meaning that we must stick together and betrayal is not an option. The problem of the informer, as I've stated before, is a key theme in a lot of the Mishnah, the Gemara, and the rabbinics, the people who betray what Jews have done to the authorities, thus leading to the persecution of the Jews, and thus they become enemies of the Jewish community. And of course, the punishment prescribed by the Mishnah directly is death.
Wow.
Okay.
I guess that's why they stick together
Yes,
so
it's one of
much.
their it's one of the more interesting aspects of the rabbinics is that you don't hear a lot of mention of the issue of the informers, precisely because so much literature ends in that phrase, "They shall be condemned to death," and the discussion tends to be how are we going to do that in a situation where we do not formally have the power to do so, like the Kingdom of Poland, where Jews were told to once a judgment had been decided on, they should go and in a mob and kill him, and it would be judged an unlawful killing. But then the culprits would not be found, if you like. It's a bit like settler killings today. The culprits it happens, but the culprits are never found. It's strange that.
Right.
Sometime after this meeting, Antabi located a young Jew named Isaac Yavor, who had a stand in the traditional market for Alab Nargilis, our water pipe. Nobody seems to know quite how Yavo was located. Antabi doesn't mention it, and it was sometime after the meeting, which suggests that Yavo was not present, and that there's something had happened. We don't really know what. He claimed to have seen Thomas and Amala heading out to the Damascus suburb of Salihi through the Western Gate, which is the opposite gate to the Jewish quarter. Yavo claims to have called out to Amala, asking him to purchase some goods from him, but Amala declined to do so. Interestingly, in regard to this supposed testimony, Yavo's mother would not let him testify, which is difficult to explain if we accept Antabi just finding out in first place about Yavo's testimony before Rabbi Menton. The pro-Jewish historians tend to claim that she was fearful, reasoning that from hindsight, the battle later used other bastinado and ice baths to elicit some of the confessions that later occurred. But another more plausible suggestion presents itself, that Yavo, who we knew from his later conduct was a very devout Jew and quite probably a religious fanatic, was coached by Entabbe to get rid of the problem by presenting evidence to Rabbi Menton and Shelley Pasha that would lead them to move their investigation away from the Jewish community. This would nicely explain the mother's odd action and how stalwart she kept at it, in addition to Entabbe's odd ability to procure a witness in uncertain circumstances on demand. In addition, we should note that no other witness, in spite of this being a very busy area, would came forward to say they had seen Father Thomas at this time, even though it was at the busiest hour of the day, and there were many, many merchants there, and there were the city guards there. Yet no one else saw Father Thomas and Amala apart from Yavo, supposedly anyway. And Tabby, at this point, was desperate to remove Yavo's mother's influence from the equation. So he organized a wealthy European Jewish merchant who lived in Damascus, who had powerful friends via his family's consular service to Austria, Denmark, and Prussia in the nearby city of Aleppo, called Isaac Epikioto, and by extension, Shelley Pasha, of course. That nothing, and basically he this Picciotto was to try and to convince Rabbi Menton that nothing would happen to was basically get a guarantee from Rabbi Menton that nothing would happen to Yavo regardless of what happened, so his mother would release him to testify because presumably she was afraid that if caught lying to protect the Jews, Yavo, because if of course any mistake would as it, what in fact happened would bring on the bastinado, and there would be a big investigation, and an awful lot would come to light, which Antabi and the other Jews of Damascus would not want to have come to light. One of the things that makes sense, it kind of makes sense of why Yavo was doing it, because he had to protect, he thought it's his religious duty to protect the Jewish community from what they could perhaps see was about to happen in terms of there being a ritual murder accusation or some kind of murder accusation against the Jews. and his mother wanting to protect her son from the potential consequences, aka lying to the absolute ruler of a city, who would almost certainly then torture her son and then kill him. At this point, and while Picciotto was doing this, a small group of the elite of the community, most of whom were later implicated in the murders, which included Meir Farhi, Mulhad Farhi, Joseph Farhi, David Halahi, Isaac Halahi, Joseph Halahi, Alan Stalamboli, and Haddad Lisbona, many of whom had formerly held high-ranking positions in the Ottoman administration of Damascus, while Lisbona was still in a position of authority as a banker to Sherif Pasha's government, as was Rafael Fahi, who was not present at the time. The purpose of this meeting was to work out what course of action the Jewish community should take if Yahweh's testimony was not accepted, which implies they had a good reason for suspecting it might not be, i.e. if Yahweh broke down under questioning and his religious fervour was not quite as fervent as might seem to be the case, precisely because Yahweh was a very young man, and as we well know, young men are prone to fanaticism, but at the same time are very easy to break. In addition to this, the course of action decided upon was to offer a large reward, i.e. $2,500 in European money, for information leading to the investigation away from the Jewish community, and to begin bribing important local officials to make, via the custom of bakshish, i.e. a small bribe to speed the wheels of bureaucracy, not as sometimes deliberately misinterpreted by pro-Jewish historians, to distort it, the case to go away, basically to pay the money so it would go away.
My goodness.
Some of the group then called on the non-Jewish chief accountant, the new one, of the government's treasury, Hannah Bahi B, who refused the money and basically said, he says, I wouldn't have anything to do with this, in spite of taking the time to hear them out. The group then approached Ali Agha, the chief of police, who'd been doing the searching and didn't find anything on the first pass, so to say. The chief of police, who was a notorious spendthrift and had long been in the pocket of the Jewish Fahi family, who had arranged to cut Agha in on some of their mercantile transactions if he left the goods alone and didn't inspect them too closely. Agha seems to have accepted the bribe and was later accused and disgraced for having been deliberately lax in his searches, doing just enough to seem diligent, but not actually looking properly of Jewish properties because of this bribe and his lucrative connection to the Fahi family. After this, the group went to call on Shalif Pasha to make their case for dropping the investigation in light of what they'd just been doing. And while they're waiting for an audience, Shahabid Lisbona tried to quietly bribe one of the Pasha's closest advisors, a Christian named Ayub Shubli, with about $5 worth of money. Shubli became offended at so low a bribe, especially considering the amount of money he knew these Jews had.
Right.
And accused the Jews openly of trying to bribe him.
Hmm.
When questioned by the Pasha on Lisbona admitted that he had done so because he was afraid of what he thought was about to happen. Strange that, considering they knew it was, they seemed to have known what was about to happen before it was to happen.
Right.
In spite of this, Rafael Farhi, again, one of the most powerful Jews in the city, and Isaac Picciotto, who is under the protection of the Austrian consulate, who both by now joined the group, were allowed to have an audience with the Pasha. And while making their case, asked a lot of questions about what was known by the authorities. So that even the most pro-Jewish historians, like former Florence and the Hebrew University scholar Jonathan Frankel, claim that they were going there to extract intelligence as to where the investigation had got to and how much the authorities knew. News of the conduct of the elite of the Jewish community, however, got out, and to the non-Jewish citizens of Damascus, it seemed proof positive that the Jews had something to do with Thomas and Demar's disappearance, which is not really very surprising. Moving on, we move to the interrogation of Solomon al-Halak, which was going on at about the same time, by Rati Menton, who is, after all, a qualified lawyer and an advocate. I said, Salim Halahalak was a Jewish barber, was a poor Jewish barber, and he began to fall apart fairly quickly. He could not account for why Father Thomas's notice about the charity auction had been high up on the wall outside of his shop. Thomas and Amara were small men and were not able to reach this height, while Halak could have done. When witnesses had seen Thomas put it on the door of synagogue that day, Al-Halak claimed that it must have fallen off and that he must have not seen the notice personally, but then accidentally stated how many sealing wafers had been used and what colour these had been, i.e. one red and one lilac. Al-Halak then changed his story and stated that he had possibly put the notice back up once it had fallen off. Fatim Menton then disproved this by pointing out that the sealing wafers had been used for the first time, i.e. they hadn't been reused, and were completely different from all other materials used to stick up the other notices that Thomas had posted. Al-Halak continued to change his story and not be able to account for discrepancies in the story for 3 days until Fatim Menton, tired of trying to get him to tell the truth, and formally brought him before Sharif Pasha and put him in prison. Sharif Pasha, at this point, did something that was quite magnanimous. He said he promptly offered him, Al-Halak, a poor man who had been living on the charity of the Jewish elite, I might add, about $1,000 and a full pardon if he confessed to the murder so that the mystery could be solved and any accomplices dealt with. This is fairly common practice in the Islamic world. Al-Halak's response to this offer was a very strange one for a man who was in the situation. He said, go to the important people in the Jewish quarter. They will settle everything. In effect, Al-Halak was stating that the elite of the Jewish community knew what had happened and that they would be happy to offer the Pasha a bribe if he would be so kind as to drop what was the sort of progressing investigation. This is confirmed by Al-Halak's testimony to Al-Talihi in prison, in his prison cell shortly after the event, when he says, quite simply, tell the Pasha to arrest the important people in our nation. Those people know the answers, i.k.a. they know what actually happened. I'm only a pawn in this.
Right.
At this point, the Pasha changed his attitude to Al-Halak because he began to realize that something was wrong here. He decided that the bastinado should be used against Halak, which was bastinado effectively means that someone is strapped down and their feet are whipped with a reed cane. It's like having been caned repeatedly.
Okay.
And it's done on the buttocks and the feet and the soles of the feet. It causes a lot of pain, but it doesn't kill you. he opened up this testimony, which he never contradicted. Not even once the possibility of a death sentence and any further torture had been completely removed by Clemio and Montefiore. He stuck to it his whole life, and he never repudiated, much as we'll see that the servant of the Halahis, Al-Fatal, was exactly the same. Now, Al-Halik's new testimony made more sense, and that he did not know any of the great and good of the Jewish community, but that the servant of David Halahi, one of the Jews doing the bribing and the second wealthiest Jew in the city, with a massive personal fortune, who and his servant was Mulad Al-Fatal, had come by his shop on Wednesday afternoon and asked him to come to his master's house that moment to bleed him, per the common medical practice of the time. Al-Halak testified quite reasonably that given that he was supported in part by that family, that he dare not refuse and promptly left with Al-Fatal. Once he'd arrived, Al-Halak testified he was led to a room where he found Father Thomas stretched out on a raised section of the floor, a sort of dais of sort, where Father Thomas's arms were tied behind his back in addition to his being gagged. Thomas was being held down by David Halahi, his brother Isaac Halahi, Alan Halahi, their uncles Rabbi Joseph Leninado and Joseph Halahi, in addition to Rabbi Moses Ahufula and Rabbi Moses Solinchi. David Halahi then ordered Al-Halak to slit Thomas's throat.
Whoa!
Yeah. saying to refuse to do so and fled. Al-Halak initially denied having cut Thomas's neck at the command, but he later admitted on Friday the 20th of February having done so, and was quite specific in that he said he cut Thomas's throat, collected the blood in a copper basin, the purpose for the use, however, he didn't pay attention to what the others were doing with the blood. He cut up Thomas's body, smashed his skull on the floor,
which
is covered in debris, probably sand, as later discovered. Then he put, and then he put the remains in a coffee sack, again, which is a fairly significant detail, because coffee sacks at that time were quite solid things. They were not prone to leak, and they would be able to take liquid very quickly, so they wouldn't leak liquid if they were dragged throughout the streets.
Right.
Then he disposed of this sack with Thomas's remains in this ancient sewers, which again is an interesting detail because the sewers run directly, were the only part of the sewers run directly under the Jewish quarter. So they had all these ancient sewers, and these run under the Jewish quarter, and the Jewish quarter had specific culverts which they could use for their own waste. And in addition to this, so we can prove that he is telling the truth here, because Al-Halak later directed Ratimenton and the Pasha's soldiers to a very specific sewer where he said he disposed of the bodies. Ratimenton found human bones, which were verified as human by two physicians independently, flesh, part of Thomas's skull cap, and scalp, easily distinguished by the distinctive tonsure, so you could see the bald patch and the hair around it, which was the same colour as Thomas's hair. In addition to Thomas's Capuchin skull cap, again very very distinctive in terms of Catholic ritual, proving the truth of what he had said despite some of the more unorthodox methods of actually gaining that testimony. On the Thursday, Alon Harhi had called on him and offered him $100. And again, remember, he was a very poor man. This was an awful lot of money to him, to Al-Halak. On David Harahi's behalf, if he would keep quiet and put up the notice that had in the meantime been taken down. Alon Harahi had provided the sealing wafers, explaining where they'd come from. In addition to this, the Harahi family had promised that if he was ever taken to prison for the crime they would look after all his wants of his family, which explains Al-Halak's initial reticence to do so, and also why he kept his story up, because he realised that he could not go back to this deal, having actually testified as to what happened.
Right.
In addition, when he was arrested on the Sunday, he testified that David Halaki had hastened towards him and called out not to be afraid and that they would give him money. This was later confirmed by the Pasha's soldiers. News of Halak's testimony quickly leaked out to the Jewish community, of course, because they had friends in high places, and that it was clear that a wave of arrests would quickly follow, which prompted Jews to begin looking for ways to escape Damascus. One of the more popular was to pay Muslim families to hide them. And we know of several of the culprits who did just this and were never found during the course of the entire investigation. Some of them remained successfully hidden for the entire duration of the affair, and others were caught. And, for example, children of others were found hidden in Muslim households, and the Muslim families testified they'd been paid a large amount of money to hide these children. when the wave of arrests did come, it was accompanied by a new wave of searches of Jewish houses by the Pasha's troops, who would concentrate on those Jews who were named. These were followed by mobs of Christians and Muslims shouting abuse at and sometimes attacking the Jews in the streets. One thing that did become apparent was in the house searches was how massively wealthy the Jews of Damascus were, and this was quite scary for the Muslim troops. Indeed, Raphael Fahi's wife, they recovered two large diamonds that were combined worth more than the entire German principality.
Oh, my goodness.
It was during these searches, again, we have allegations of wrongdoing. made in July, August 1840 to Clemio and Montefiore, claiming that Ratimenton was sexually harassing the Jewesses concerned, tried to abduct David Halahi's daughter, sung Esther Lignato's, Rabbi Leander's wife, Arabic love song to try and convince her to come with him and be his wife. We know that these are made up, however, because the women would never repeat the claims in open court, as they had not, they'd be asked to prove them, which they couldn't do. And also the Pasha's soldiers, who were asked, said this was completely untrue. And we also know that it couldn't be true because Ratimenton was not able to speak proper Arabic at this stage, let alone sing Arabic love songs to people.
Oh my goodness. So basically they conjured up a bunch of stories saying that they were being victimized and everything in order to cover up their own crimes and in order to gain the notoriety for being victimized from the international jury, right?
Yes, at this time, that's exactly what they were doing. And also, we should note that they were, at this very early stage, they were beginning to argue that there was an anti-Semitic conspiracy, in effect. And they particularly singled out Jean-Baptiste Bourdin. Because Bourdin, in addition to all his responsibilities as being an agent of the French crown at this point, also acted as a factor for European merchants, Gentile European merchants, who had loaned them money or had sold goods to them and they hadn't paid them. So he would act on their behalf and would visit the houses of the Jews, asking them to repay their money. And they repeatedly throughout the investigation accused him of extorting them, of being trying to get money out of them, bribes, what have you. And it's just you see it throughout the investigation. There are claims that there's an anti-Semitic conspiracy going on, and that it's all in the irrational superstition and so forth. So the next witness who was subject to interrogation was David Halahi's servant Al-Fatal, who immediately admitted that he had been sent to fetch Al-Halak that day, but had not come back to the house with the barber, which contradicted Al-Halak's wife's testimony, which supported her husband's. Al-Halak, however, later admitted, Al-Fatal, however, later admitted in very similar testimony, but not completely identical, which any policeman will tell you is a normal sign of a forced confession, in that it is too perfect. So the fact that Al-Fatal's confession is close, but it differs in a couple of details, suggests that it is in fact genuine. He stated that he was offered an arranged match by David Halahi, in addition to money and the cost of his future wedding, because he was unmarried at this point. Again, a very unusual gift to be offered if someone is making up as they go along, because you expect they said, "Oh, well, I'll make you a millionaire," kind of thing, rather than "I will get you a wife, I will pay for your wedding, I will do this for you, I'll do that for you, and you can become a rich and powerful Jew in your own right." But the wedding detail probably tells us we're dealing with something genuine here.
Sure.
Nice side detail. But he had not taken part in the actual killing itself. He had merely fetched Al-Halak and then helped to get rid of the body, as he was ordered to by his master. It's worth noting, in both sets of testimony, only Al-Halak and Al-Fatal are doing the disposing, which again fits Middle Eastern mores at the time, and indicates that they are telling the truth, because normally you have all the main Jews who are getting rid of the body. But in this case, when we're dealing with something that's obviously quite genuine, because of the fact the servants are doing it.
Right. And so it was basically the elite Jews who participated in a ritual murder and then ordered their servants to get rid of the body.
Yep.
My goodness.
And again, we know that Al-Halak and Al-Fatal are likely telling the truth, because red stains were later found in the room they identified on the bottom of the walls. In addition to the floor having been particularly well cleaned recently, and there being a discoloured patch on the floor from a recent fire, which matches both testimonies fairly exactly, in that both of them mentioned that the clothes that the servant and his the father and his servant were burned. In addition to the 7th of March testimony that Ratimenton led a search party to search, and for another, access to a sewer that Al-Fatah had identified separately as being where he had dumped the dismembered corpse of Amala, the Thothmes' servant, who had also been killed in a similar fashion after having persisted in trying to locate his master in the Jewish quarter. Bâtiment and his soldiers discovered more bones, identified as human by two physicians, another physician arranged by the Austrian vice consul, Caspar Melato, declared the bones to be an animal, more Melato later, and part of a cap and part of a shoe that Amala's brother stated clearly and consistently had been his brother's, and he was called to examine them several times, and he showed other shoes and so forth to see whether he was lying, and he was not. And he did say he identified them on the basis of certain marks and distinguishing marks that were present. As the Jews had done, who had later done all the killing, David Hadi claimed that he had been at the house of a Christian merchant, Georgios Ankouli, on Wednesday afternoon, but Ankouli stated that this was incorrect and that Hadi had come over for the afternoon on the Thursday, not Wednesday. Further, the officials at the customs house that Halahi had said he had been visited before going to Ankouli's supported Ankouli and in that said that it had been on Thursday, not Wednesday, that Halahi had come. This lack of an alibi, and indeed lack of verifiable whereabouts whatsoever, was echoed by Isaac Halahi, Joseph Halahi, Ahan Halahi, Rabbi Moses Abu Fula, and Rabbi Moses Salonici. Salonici refused to name two guests who he claimed had been at his house at the evening where he was supposed to be at the ritual murder, but he refused to name them, of course, and he never produced the names, not even to the Jews who later interrogated him, as to who they were, so they could disprove it. So basically, the Jews have no alibis.
So what occurred as a result of this ritual murder? And what did the people in London, how did they respond? How did the British government respond? And you also mentioned that this was basically the first time that they talked about 6 million.
Yes, because what happens later is that after all this has occurred, is that we begin to see Jewish involvement fairly early in international terms. That comes in the form of Caspar Melato, as I mentioned. Now, Melato is an interesting figure because he was an insurance agent. He had come to Damascus to make his fortune, but his business was not good. He had made virtually no money. He was broke. But yet, a few days before, he suddenly changed his mind about the ritual murder. Before, he'd been supporting the idea. Then all of a sudden, he changed his mind and said it was not true. He began to argue against it. The couple of days before that, he moved into a brand new massive house, which was very expensive, and he suddenly started flashing about a lot of money. This can either be dated to something to do with the Fahis or the Halahis, we don't know. However, there is another connection very strongly represented, in that his direct superior in Alexandria was a man named von Laren. Von Laren was an Austrian lawyer, and he was in, as we know, Prince Metternich's service. He wrote detailed work to Metternich about the affair, always from a pro-Jewish standpoint, and he also directly corresponded with the Austrian consul in Paris. Now, who might that be? James de Rothschild. He wrote a direct letter to James de Rothschild outlining what was happening in Damascus, which he knew would then go straight to all the other Rothschilds in the world. And they began to very quickly mobilize large numbers of powerful Jews. We have Solomon de Rothschild, who is the Austrian Rothschild. We have James de Rothschild, and we have the London Rothschilds, all at this time beginning to share correspondence in their own secret cipher system, which they called Judendeutsch, which is a form of Hebrew mixed with Yiddish, so it makes it incomprehensible to any speaker of Yiddish or Hebrew to understand, or even German. They then began to to talk to their essential political opponents, people like the Goldschmidts, the Montefiores, as well as their contacts in the chancelleries of Europe. So they, for example, they talked to Lord Palmerston, who was the British Prime Minister at the time. Now, the interesting thing about Palmerston at this point is that Palmerston was already not very well disposed towards Ali Muhammad and his empire, his new empire, because Palmerston was deeply involved in Afghanistan and wanted to see a strong Ottoman Empire and was pressuring Ali Muhammad to give back Syria to the Ottomans. What then transpired was that they began to organize meetings at the Board of Jewish Deputies. The Chambre, the deputies, had a Jewish banker in it who immediately began making speeches. A young radical lawyer, Adolphe Prémur, then came on the scene. He began to write attacks on the trial going on in the Journal de Debat, which was one of the few journals that would publish it, because the radical press wouldn't touch it, because they didn't want to take a stance on the issue. The conservative press was defending the trial, and the Catholic press was rapidly promoting the trial. So Clémieux was getting frustrated. He couldn't convince Adolphe Thiers, the French premier, to take any action, because Thiers didn't want to get involved with it, because that would be seen to be pro-British. And he also believed that it was a genuine case based on Ratisbonne's dispatches, as well as the support offered to Ratisbonne by his superior in Alexandria, Cochollet. This kind of created a situation where Clémieux had got so frustrated that he went to the Rothschilds and he went to Britain to a meeting of the Board of Jewish Deputies, and that was conducted between a lot of ostensible Jewish opponents. You had the Goldschmidts, who were conservatives, so the Goldschmidts, who were the radicals. You had the Rothschilds, who were conservatives, and you had an absolute radical like Clémieux involved. And you had later on radical socialists involved in trying to destroy this trial. It's a situation where they've all agreed that they need to stop this. They need to destroy it. And it's not about whether or not the Jews are guilty. It's about stopping a ritual murder trial, because if they realize that a ritual murder trial at this time would open a can of worms. Because every ritual murder trial in history would then be reopened and re-examined. And all the accusations against the Jews made historically that they had spent the last 100 years attacking would be re-examined in a new positive light, because there was now a precedent. They then prepared an invest. They then sent, it was about 5,000 US dollars to Damascus. This was to help ostensibly to help the Jews who were suffering, but seems to have been actually used for bribes or attempted bribes. While this is going on, you had some Jews from Alexandria who may or may not have done it on their own initiative, or have done it at the behest of European Jews. Go to Damascus, and they began to conduct their own investigation. Now, the problem occurred quite quickly, because they were caught bribing local officials, and the local officials actually did an old version of a sting on them. They invited them to their parlors, and they had soldiers waiting, and the Jews then offered them large amount of money so that they could make, in the words of the Jews, make the trial go away. This then caused the situation in Damascus to escalate, as by this point the Shedev Pasha was convinced the Jews were guilty, the Ratisbonne was convinced they were guilty, the British vice consul in Damascus was convinced they were guilty. Basically, all the players in Damascus on the ground were convinced the Jews were guilty. However, apart from Caspar Melato, who, as we've seen, had an ulterior motive and he appears to have been bribed, But in Alexandria, it was a different matter. You had Colonel Hodges, who was the British representative, and you had von Lauren, who were actually working against it and were working with the Jews to support the Jews who were subject to the investigation. In addition, a British Jew who had gone to Alexandria recently, a converted rabbi from Weymouth of all places, he went to Damascus again to try and ascertain what had gone on. Now, he was important because he began to try and construct testimony to defend the Jews, and it is from him that we begin to see a lot of the scare stories appearing. People stating that the Jews were being maltreated, were being killed, or were in hiding out of fear, and so forth. And again, it's about this time that we begin to see Adolf Clemieux bring in the figure of 6 million. The 6 million comes from the Journal des Débats, where he cites it in an article, talking about it when he says that the 6 million Jews of the world are waiting to be, you know, are going to be persecuted if this comes to pass, and so on and so forth. So Clemieux and the British Jews reach an agreement. They agree that it is time to send a delegation to Damascus through Alexandria, and their stated purpose is to stop the trial and to look into what's going on, and so on and so forth. The two people they choose are Adolf Clemieux, who was a radical lawyer, who was the brains of the business, if you like. He was a very intelligent man, even if we may not like him. And Moses Montefiore, who was a bit of a poltroon, I think would be the best term for him, in that he was a former governor of the City of London, and he was a banker, so forth, made his money. And he loved to strut around in a uniform of the guard, of the British, you know, elite guard regiments, even though he'd never served a day in the military in his life. So he would go there as a big, you know, the aristocratic figure, the important figure with big connections in the British government, who would be allowed to negotiate on behalf of the British. He tried to get a formal letter of introduction from Lord Palmerston, but Lord Palmerston didn't want to go quite that far. He allowed the Lord Ashley, who was the leader of the London Society for Propagation of Christianity among the Jews and a leading fellow Semite, to write such a letter for Palmerston, but nevertheless he didn't do one himself. On the way there, Clemieux and Montefiore fell out in a fairly big way, as well as their wives fell out in a fairly big way. They had arguments over who got the best cabin, who was to take the lead, what strategy to use, and they never seemed to have agreed on anything apart from the fact that they wanted to stop this ritual murder trial. When they finally got to Alexandria, this was after a long, long time, and there had been several fights between them. There had been an additional two ritual murder accusations that were going on, one in Rhodes and one in Alexandria itself. So their worst nightmare was coming true.
Wow.
These charges were spreading, and they were spreading quickly, and they were provoking independent investigations into the phenomena. Once they arrived in Alexandria, Clemieux immediately began talking to Cochulet, who he realized was the key figure in all this, because Cochulet was Rethymnon's superior and Thiers's sort of key contact in the Middle East. If he could get the French to abandon the trial in such a way as to make the land a safe face, he realized he could more or less prevent them from doing so. So Clemieux began to negotiate Cochulet, and it took him several weeks of negotiation, and he didn't get anywhere because Cochulet would not budge. Cochulet just would stated that although he abstained from whether it was the the Jews were guilty or not in Damascus, he trusted Raphael Menton's judgment as a lawyer and advocate and as an honest Frenchman. And Clémieux was unable to get any traction at all. Montefiore was even worse. He went to the Pasha, and the Pasha just effectively told him outright to his face that although he was a great and important person, he would not stop this trial because it was a matter of local justice. At this point,
what did they do? They sent in military troops.
That comes later. At this point, they were unable to reach a compromise. However, at about the same time, Lord Palmerston had issued an ultimatum with Austria, and this was likely with Rothschild's support, because of course the Rothschilds were big political players, and even previous historians will account the fact that there was a big Rothschild power base behind this particular action, in that a fleet of British and Austrian ships anchored in the Bay of Alexandria, and they started taking soundings of the harbour to prepare for a landing. While the British and Austrians, with Prussian support, were demanding that Ali Mohammed cede Syria back to the Ottoman Empire, and that if he would do so, they would allow him to remain in power. Otherwise, every 10 days, he would lose another province when they came for him. And if he carried on for another month, they would then come and depose him with their forces.
Oh my goodness!
So he was between a rock and a hard place. And bear in mind that Ali Mohammed was an old man at this point. He was an old man. He was surrounded by flatterers. He had a powerful army, but compared to European armies, it was no match. And he, at this point, he was tired. He was still backing his adopted son in Damascus, who was still wanting to go ahead with to execute the Jews as he had himself decided that they were guilty and was going to go forward with it. Now, at this point, Clémieux had a massive stroke of luck. Two of Ali Mohammed's physicians were Europeans. Both of them were treating the Sultan. As it happens, for a common enough problem, which was he had an abscess on his bum. Now, this could be fatal. And was frequently so. Basically, he had a very, very pocket of pus on his hindquarters, and it needed to be destroyed in an age before antiseptic. This was a very dangerous, dangerous exercise, to the extent where Nathan Rothschild, one of the British Rothschilds, had died from it a few years earlier from such an operation, even with the best of healthcare. Now, they, in dealing with this abscess, had intimate access to the Sultan. So Clémieux tried one last card. He tried to get the Sultan, he tried to get these two physicians to intercede for the Sultan. And the Sultan, at this point, stressed with the potential of invasion, having lost, losing all his hard-won territory, gave in. He said, I want nothing more to do with this. I will give the Ottoman Empire back Syria. I will pardon the Jews. This wasn't good enough for Clémieux. He rejoiced in the fact that he had got what he wanted, more or less, but he was trying to come up with an absolute destruction of the ritual murder charge. He wasn't interested in whether the Jews were actually guilty. He wanted to stop them. He wanted to stop the ritual murder charge in its tracks.
Sure.
Again, Montefiore and because Clémieux fell out about this time. Again, Montefiore claimed it was all his influence. Clémieux claimed it was all his. and they were having a very, very large scrap about this until they both died, actually, as to who got credit. So that, in a nutshell, is Damascus. That is Damascus 1840. That we have, it is not a charge, it is a ritual murder trial, which was never disproven, was only ever nullified. So it was a case where the ritual murder charge was not was never debunked. It's only been attacked by later historians. It was only ever nullified, and we have a case of, as an obvious Jewish power being used to subvert and prevent a trial that was not in the interest of jury. And again, we can see that it's the first major instance that we can prove absolutely where Rothschilds, Goldschmidts, Montefiores, the whole Jewish power base came together to stop something that was not in their interests.
And didn't they make it seem like the Jews were the poor victims because everybody was ganging up on them, and they needed to bring in forces, military forces, to prevent the Jews from perishing?
Yes, that's true. That's one way how the regiment rationalized it in the Board of Jewish Deputies, publications on the article, and in later pro-Jewish treatises on the subject. It was a kind of, we had to do this because if we didn't, then the Jews would have been killed, and there would have been pogroms, and you know, the same old, if you like.
Right, and didn't they start collecting money in order to?
They had a very large subscription, which amounted to about $10,000, which was again sent to Damascus, to the Jews of Damascus, who, again, we have no record of how it was used. It is doubtful it was used by the poor, because although there were poor Jews in Damascus, the Jews of Damascus had more than enough money, and there were a lot of Jews in Damascus. A lot of these rich families were not in jail at the time, and nor were their finances stuck, and they continued to trade and to send goods elsewhere. In fact, they often hired bodyguards because of the fact they were so scared of what was going to happen to them in the streets and that kind of thing.
Unbelievable! What an operation to change everything, to hide everything, to conceal their crimes.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
And the scale of Damascus is quite incredible. It's why it's often referred to as the founding of modern Jewish advocacy, because it's the first time that this really occurs. This is the era before the ADL, before there was any major Jewish organization, and the Universal Jewish Alliance is how it translates, sorry, I can't say it in the French. That first organization, again, connection to Freemasonry, because Clémyot was a very keen Freemason and a rationalist. He also hated Christianity, I might add.
Right. Oh my goodness. What a fascinating story.
It's a very, very fascinating one, and
yes,
deserves a book, I think, a proper one.
Oh, indeed. You need to write one.
Oh, another one.
Yes, indeed. Well, thank you so much for sharing this with us. This is wonderful information, and I do really hope that you put this in a book. This story needs to be told, because we don't know the details of what you just shared with us. These are details I've never heard before, and just the whole issue of ritual murder needs to be explored on a deeper level.
There is quite a lot of anti-Jewish literature on the ritual murder. However, it is rather old. It's old, and it's in older languages. There's a lot in German, there's a lot in French, but there is very, very little in English.
Right.
Unfortunately. Probably because there is no strong anti-Jewish tradition in the Anglophone world. There has never really been one that's been really as powerful as anything like as, you know, as potent in the intellectual world as how you have in the French and the German traditions.
Yes. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate you doing this. And we'll have to do this again.
Oh, that's great. Thank you very much.
Okay. Take care.
Okay, thank you.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.